is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is your host, Dr. Hal Schurz, and along with my co-host, Dr. Michael Karuchik, we come to you every week to discuss topics that doctors discuss between themselves and every healthcare topic imaginable. And we let you in on those private discussions so that you'll be armed with information that you'll need to fight for your healthcare freedom. Our show is brought to you every week by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, which is a non-for-profit, tax-deductible organization. It was founded by doctors who are deeply concerned with the direction that healthcare is going in. And the foundation offers solutions that are very different than what's been enacted by bureaucrats in Washington, who believe that they know better than you do about the kind of healthcare you should have, who should deliver it to you, and where. The foundation lives on the contributions from the public, and so I would urge you to go to the website www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org, and make a generous contribution so that we can continue to bring high quality shows like the Doctor's Lounge to you every week. Well, today I have the privilege and pleasure to have with me a guest who is a leader in healthcare, both as an academician and as a freedom fighter for healthcare freedom for both doctors and for patients. My guest today is Dr. Paul Tierstein, who is the chief of cardiology and the director of interventional cardiology at the Scripps Clinic in San Diego, California. And he has a very impressive professional bio that encompasses the whole realm of cardiology. He's an internationally known speaker and innovator in cardiology and a very well-accomplished clinician and a medical researcher with a very impressive list of peer-reviewed articles. But what brings Dr. Tierstein to our show today is his leadership and his role in this fight, this battle that is occurring for the very heart and soul of medicine between the doctors who belong to specialty organizations and the organizations themselves that are trying to control the enterprise of medicine and control the activity of doctors. And Dr. Tierstein is responsible for creating an alternative to doctors who wish to get out from under the thumb of the boards that control the doctors. And I'm not going to pontificate any further. I'm going to let you get into the conversation with us, Paul, and we're going to get into this. So I'd like to welcome you, Paul, to the Doctor's Lounge this morning.
Hey, thanks for giving me the opportunity to be on the show.
Well,
good morning.
Good morning. And this is a topic that we've talked about on the Doctor's Lounge previously. We've had others speaking about it, some of whom you're very well acquainted with, like Dr. Paul Kempen, for example, and Jeff Singer, who's a general surgeon in Arizona. But you know, we're talking today to more than just doctors, Paul. We're talking to a general audience that may not understand what the whole topic is all about. So can you just give a little bit of a background about specialty boards, board certification,
sure,
and how and why this has come about?
Sure. That's actually very complicated for non-physicians to grasp the significance of this, because it's very nuanced and relates to our very detailed and specific issues that come up during the physician training. So this got its start, I think it's about 80 years ago, when there were some concerns about physician competence. And a lot of people don't know this, but to practice medicine, you don't have to be board certified. You have to be licensed by your state. And that's really all that's required. So you have to go through medical school and take some tests but you don't have to really do further training programs. And so the boards and the national certifications got started in the early part of the last century when there were individuals practicing as physicians, and they were kind of quacks. This is how I understand it. And so the boards were formed as a way to certify doctors, sort of like a stamp, grade A beef, you know, to try to distinguish doctors who were really competent and well-trained from the average or maybe less than competent doctor. So the way this evolved was into right now there are 24 recognized boards, and that means that if you go to a family practice doctor, they probably will have taken their boards in family practice. If you go to a cardiologist, they will have done it in cardiology, and urology will be urology. But it goes a little deeper than that because each board often offers more than one specialty, and so some of us have more than one board that we've taken, and we're certified in more than one specialty. So I'm certified in internal medicine and cardiology, and then again in interventional cardiology. To get the stamp of certification, what you do as a physician is after medical school, you go through some years of training. It's usually a pretty intense training experience where you're working, you know, 80 to 100 hours a week, and it goes on for anywhere, but usually 3 years for each board. Some of the boards are a little shorter. Interventional cardiology is only 1 year, but internal medicine is 3 years, cardiology is 3 years. And the training program has to be audited and vetted by an organization. This is the American College of Graduate Medical Education, ACGME, does that. And the program gets a site visit every few years and really gets evaluated. So it's got to be a pretty strong, formal program. And then at the end of the program, your program director signs off on the doctor and says, yep, this physician trained fulfilled all 3 years and 36 months of required training and has done a good job. And that allows you to take a test. That test is your final board exam, and it's very much like a final exam in your field. It covers pretty much everything that you've learned, and it's hard. Not everyone passes it, and you have to study for it. It's a little bit like the bar exam for lawyers. A lot of fields have this kind of exam. And then once you pass that, then you get a certificate saying that you're board certified by the particular board that you belong to, that was the relevant board for your field of expertise. Up until 1990, that certification was lifelong, and you were certified forever. In 1990, things started changing for internal medicine. I think it changed at different time periods and for the different boards. But in the 90s, basically, most of these boards stopped being lifelong. And they became something that was time limited. So for internal medicine, it was every 10 years. So you had to recertify. What does recertifying mean? Well, it meant a number of things. Sitting usually in front of a computer and completing certain modules which tested your medical knowledge on different subjects. Involved, in some cases, giving evaluations to your patients to see how your practice is doing and acting on those evaluations and taking another test about 10 years into the later. So that sounds sort of okay. At 10 years, well, you've got to take some prep modules, and you have to take another test, and you have to get some evaluations back from your patients. It sounds nice. But it actually wasn't very helpful, and it was really a pain in the neck, and it didn't really bring any value to you or your practice. Why wouldn't it bring value? Well, because the computer modules, either you knew the answer to the question, or the question didn't really apply to your practice. Same thing for the test questions at every 10 years. You have to go and study for that, and in many cases go and leave town and go to a review course. And it sounds good, I realize that, but in actuality, all you learn are the things that you don't use. Medicine is very, very diverse now, and it doesn't matter how general practitioner you are, you're going to be end up specializing to a certain extent because it's so impossible to learn everything. And so you're taking a test. Some nice, good examples are the anesthesiologist who treats adults has to spend a lot of time learning how to do anesthesiology for children because that's on the test. That's what they have to study, but of course they don't treat children, so they forget everything they learn really the year, by a year after you've taken the test, you've forgotten it because you don't use it. And there's many, many, many examples of this. The test questions really are very easy for those questions that are in your field, but then the ones that are not in your field, you really got to study for it, or else you're going to fail. The patient evaluation sounds good, right? Sounds like when I go to Best Buy and get a computer, I get an email the next day asking me about my experience. What's wrong with that?
That's right.
Well, this is not set up so well. What happens instead is you're asked to go to your patients and give them an evaluation form, which when I did it last was a telephone number that they would call, and then they would answer questions about what the practice experience was, the encounter experience was. Did you have to wait too long? Did your doctor listen to you?
How was the parking?
Yeah, how was the parking, all that. So that sounds good, right? I mean, what's wrong with that? Well, here's what's wrong with it. As a physician, you run around here. It's getting close to your 10-year period. You have to get this done. And you run around talking to your patients and asking them to fill out these forms. In my case, this is called this phone number. I think they wanted 20 evaluations. Well, I had to go to 50 patients to get 20 of them to do it. It's not just sending an email out.
No.
It's much more complicated. And, of course, you don't really go to the patients who don't like you. You go to the patients that are, it's only natural that you'll end up talking more and giving this evaluation to the patients that we have good interactions with. So you get generally a good report card, and then you have to tell them, you have to write a little essay on how you're going to improve your practice based on this data. And you say, well, you write things like, gee, I'll try to not keep patients waiting so long. I won't let my secretary interrupt me in the middle of seeing a patient. I mean, silly things that you really can't do. So really, the point is that it's really a waste of time. This was required every 10 years up until last year. And what would happen as a physician is you do it 10 years after you're in practice, and you think, wow, this is a total waste of time. But I guess I'll only have to do it one more time in 10 years because by the third time, we'll be 30 years in practice, and I'll probably be retired then. That's how
God willing.
and of course, the problem, of course, is doctors do like to work a lot. We really love our work. And actually, it's usually you do it a third time because, 40 years is a most of the doctors retire in their 70s.
Well, that's the way it used to be. That's changing considerably based on what's happening in the field.
That's true. So
we have 1 minute till our break, Paul. So wrap up, and then we'll pick
all right, so what happened, here's the problem. What happened is last January they changed the whole system so that every year you've got to participate in this. You have to have, they want you to send money in every year, and within every 2 years you have to do some form of modules and or evaluations, and it really got overwhelming to have to spend so much time on this every 2 years.
To maintain your certification.
Right. That was the name called maintenance certification. So basically the idea is it's a continuous process. You're basically doing this all the time. Sounds good, except it's really a complete waste of time.
It is. And we'll pick up on this in the next segment. You're listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. My special guest this morning is Dr. Paul Tierstein from the Scripps Clinic in San Diego, California, an interventional cardiologist and is it the president of the National Board of
yes.
Physicians and Surgeons?
Yes, that's my title.
Okay. So we left off in the last segment talking about how the American Board of Medical Specialties has created a way to certify doctors and then to have to recertify them every 10 years, but now that has gone to a process that occurs either every year or every other year by some boards called maintenance of certification.
Yeah, and doctors don't like to waste time. We're pretty busy, and the job is pretty overwhelming. A lot of multitasking, a lot of work, and the last thing you want to do is waste your time. And we've been asked to do a lot of things in the last decade that take time away from patients, take time away from our personal time, that don't seem to have meaning, whether it be requirements to fill out forms, whether it be fighting with insurance companies to get approvals. And this idea of every 2 years having to complete modules that are, having to spend basically about 20 hours a year, 10 to 20 hours a year of your time.
But sometimes
they also want some money.
But with people like you, Paul, who are triple boarded, and there are some people who even have more boards than that, it's not every 2 years, it's every year.
Right, it's about 20 hours a year is what you figure. I mean, it's not nothing. It's a, I mean, you basically, instead of going on vacation 1 year, you could spend that whole time, and people do on their vacations. It's exactly when they do it. It's the only time to do it. Getting online and answering some questions that don't relate to your practice. So a lot of us got fed up with this and thought this was overreaching. And started looking at it more critically and looking at the financial aspects of it, and we began to realize that there was no evidence that this made anyone a better doctor. In fact, just the opposite. There's been many studies done on this, and there's not a shred of evidence that show that doing this kind of continuous certification makes anyone better. And that's logical, because we're not learning anything that we need during this process. We do a lot of learning, and there's a lot of ways we learn, but not by taking these tests and filling out these forms and doing these computer modules.
It's what we call busy work.
Yeah, busy work, which is not something we really, physicians need to do. It's hard enough to get through your day. So this has resulted initially in my experience. I started a petition. We got 23,000 signatures asking the boards to recall these changes, and nothing happened. And so we started an alternative board that uses more meaningful metrics, more meaningful measurements of physician learning activity to measure the lifelong learning of a doc.
And what would those measures be?
Well, the most important thing we use is something called continuing medical education, which is pretty formal. It's usually a conference that you go to, or it could be things you read and answer questions to, but it's overseen by another organization, the ACCME. So it's not just sort of going to dinner with some of your colleagues and it's paid for by a drug company. That doesn't count. It's a educational event that is put on by a ACCME accredited organization that has very specific rules and requirements to get this accreditation regarding things like conflicts of interest, and there has to be a gap analysis done to prove that you that the doctors need to actually to learn this. And there are there's literally thousands, probably tens of thousands of continuing medical education offerings every year. And the key is that you can find one, not one, you can find many that are in your specialty specifically that you want to go to, as you have been going to for your whole career.
That will enhance your practice and help your patients specifically.
Exactly. So what you want to do when you go to a CME meeting, and I run a CME meeting, I'm a big fan of CME. CME stands for Continuing Medical Education. What you want to do is come home with something that you're going to go to your partners and say, hey, I just learned this. You know, you should know this. This is going to be helpful to our practice.
Right.
That's what you're looking for. And when you create a CME meeting, what you want your doctors to do is go home with, you know, a handful of things. If they go home with three things, that's big, that they've learned. You know, that'll change the way they practice medicine.
Right.
That's a big win. And that's because that's what we want. We want meaningful data. We want meaningful learning.
And by the way, 50 states require CME of every physician to continue to have their license renewed by the state.
Yeah, so that's what the states have come up with as a measure of lifelong learning, not taking contrived tests, you know, year after year. So that's the main difference. Is we substitute all these modules and repeat tests. We just substitute continuing medical education for these tests. And there are also some other requirements that I call more housekeeping requirements, which is you have to have a good medical license. You have to be you have to not have been kicked off the staff of your hospital. If you do surgical procedures, we want you to have credentials to do those procedures in an accredited hospital. Yet another organization accredits hospitals. And as part of that accreditation, hospitals have to have what we call peer review, where we have sessions where you're looked at by your peers and looked at your outcomes to make sure that your mortality rates and complication rates are appropriately low and success rates appropriately high. And that's done on a hospital-hospital level, and you have to have you have to have privileges if you're going to be operating on patients at least one accredited hospital.
So the point is that physicians are very, very highly regulated already. They are scrutinized. If you practice in a hospital that is a recognized hospital and you are licensed by your state, you have to already go through a certain number of measures. You have to jump through a lot of hoops already just to continue to be able to deliver medicine in this country today.
That's right.
And so the boards are yet another level that may actually be superfluous to what we're already doing.
Well, superfluous and also just unimportant and not meaningful.
Not the first time, as you've pointed out. Not the first time. Not getting that, passing that first big exam that you have to work very hard to achieve.
Yeah, the first exam that physicians are okay with, it's actually even a lot of the questions on the first exam will not ultimately relate to your final practice, but you don't know at that point what you're going to be practicing in. And so it's important that you have this general overview of everything.
Okay.
So we don't really complain or argue with that. We think that's reasonable, and we think they're doing a reasonably good job with that. We just argue with this continuous maintenance of certification as being onerous and just a time. time waster.
So why did the boards get into this? That's, I think, the crux of the matter.
I'm sorry, say that question. What,
so why did... So we have...
So what's the rationale for this?
Correct.
So the stated rationale by the boards is that there's a public outcry for maintenance of certification, that the public needs evidence that the doctors are keeping up. And that's what they say is the reason they started this. Now, I have trouble understanding that because I've never heard my patients ask me if I was board certified. I've never heard my patients ask me if I had any, how I was keeping up with it. I've never had that happen.
Nor have I.
Your career practicing. One thing that's pretty compelling, though, is the economics of maintenance. These boards are not-for-profit organizations, but as I've learned as I've grown over, not-for-profit doesn't mean not-for-revenue. A lot of the management is very highly paid. I mean, I'm talking about close to $1 million a year for these not-for-profits. Maybe over $1 million a year if you see the... I haven't seen the latest reports. Give you an example, the American Board of Internal Medicine, which certifies doctors like myself, that is a $55 million a year budget. That's a lot of money.
That's not a budget. They have a $55 million a year revenue.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's hard to spend all that, isn't it?
They have no trouble, it seems.
Well, of that, $20 million is a year is revenue from the maintenance of certification. It's very hard not to look at this and say, "Gee, this is just a revenue generator by this regulatory organization." And importantly, the regulatory organization, this is a private company. It's a not-for-profit, which means that we all get to see the books and see what people are paid and so forth. But it's not part of licensure. It's just basically some people that got together 80 years ago and said, "I think we should form a board."
That's right.
And it's basically what we did with the national board that we just started. And all this money goes to that organization, they seem to want more and more. And so it's hard to avoid seeing that glaring data point that they're making a lot of money on this. And, you know, I don't know specifically what the motivation is in people's minds, but it's hard to not include that as a potential motivation, which just infuriates the doctors.
Well, it does.
We're all working so hard, and we want to take care of patients. We don't want to waste our time. And then when we find out that there are colleagues of ours who are benefiting financially from our wasting our time, that really infuriates the doctors.
So I'll say it in a more crude way. This is basically a shakedown. It's doctors stealing money from other doctors.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's a way to look at it. I think the doctors who you think are doing stealing would not like to think of it as stealing because, you know, we agree to pay. but we're forced to agree to pay,
right?
Based on, and why would that be? So that's a good question for your listeners. Why do doctors even care?
You know,
and the reason is that what's happened now is whereas certification used to be a mark of distinction, it really isn't a mark of distinction anymore. Every hospital that's accredited in the United States pretty much has rules and regulations that almost all of them include the requirement to be certified.
So this is something that doctors are compelled to do. They can't.
Yeah, you pretty much are. You're not legally compelled, but if you want to work at most hospitals, you're going to have to. Or if you want to work at, you know, in a part of a medical organization,
right.
Scripps Clinic is my medical organization.
Right.
Requires it. Kaiser requires it.
Right.
So it's not really a market distinction. Everybody does it.
It's right. And we'll, you know, we're at a hard break right now. So we're going to pick up on why doctors give into this when we come back into the doctor's lounge.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your health care freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge with my special guest, Dr. Paul Tierstein, the president of the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons and director of interventional cardiology at Scripps Clinic in San Diego, California. We have been talking about the boards, specifically the American Board of Internal Medicine. We've been talking about licensure, maintenance of certification, a whole slew of topics about the regulation of doctors. And we left off talking about why doctors have agreed to participate in this whole process, Paul.
Why do they put up with it?
Right.
Well, most of us are busy, and we don't really care. We want to take care of our patients. We want to get our work done every day. It's a lot of work to do. We go to the office every day, a lot of work when we get home. And when it comes to these kind of issues, we tend to just put our head down and get through the day and do whatever they ask us to do. Sign more papers, whatever it is. Click on modules. All right, fine, I'll do it. Fine, I'll spend my Saturday doing that. And you just do it because it's too hard, actually, to not do it. To really stop and try to change things is very, very, takes a lot of time.
And you found that out firsthand, haven't you?
Yeah, so I've been doing this, and I spend about 3 hours a day, every day of the week on this. Some days more, very few days less. An extra 75 or so emails every afternoon. It's really an intense experience. I think it's important that doctors do, I use the expression, don't ignore the important for the urgent, which is what we tend to do. You put out whatever fire is in front of you. You call the patients who are calling with urgent problems, and then you put on the back burner the more routine issues. That's not a healthy way to run your life, because there are a lot of these issues that are not urgent but are very important, and this is one of them, and this is wasting you a lot of time. And if the doctors just take the time, if they take 1 hour or maybe even in this case 15 minutes and sign up for an alternative process, which basically is casting their vote and telling the current regulators that their system of maintenance or certification is not helpful, then that will actually make a change. And so doctors have to do this.
So how can they do this?
So what we've done is set up an alternative organization that uses much more meaningful metrics of lifelong learning. The alternative is very simple. It's called the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons, as opposed to the American Board of Medical Specialties. And so the National Board, it's NB as in boy, PAS, National Board of Physicians and Surgeons, NBPAS.org. You go onto that site and you become a member. The costs are about a quarter of what the other boards charge. and we think we can lower them as we go forward and get more and more people signed up. We are not trying to make a lot of money. I'm not paid. The people that are paid are the IT people, the lawyers, and then we have several staff now, an increasing staff of really dedicated people who are verifying all the information and making sure that all the doctor's submissions are correct. But it doesn't take a ton of money. And sign up and upload your documents that show. The hardest part is uploading your CME credits so that we know you've done 50 hours of continuing medical education within the last 2 years. Probably takes 10 minutes to do the whole application. And that is a way for physicians to, A, it's a way for them to have an alternative. B, it's a way for them to cast their vote and to be heard and say, we are not interested in doing wasting our time on the current maintenance certification. So we're doing quite well with this. We have over 1,500 now in the first 3 months have signed up. So we're on track to have, 3,000 to 5,000.
And this encompasses all specialties, not just internal medicine.
We started with mainly internal medicine and family practitioners, but then we got requests from every specialty. They're the only specialties that have not made really emotional and adamant requests. They're really more like demands that I received by email and on the website. There's only a couple of specialties that did not, and those were surgical specialties, wherein their own board. So, for example, the board for cardiac surgery. I work with a lot of cardiac surgeons, and they don't really understand see what the fuss is all about. And this is an important point for physicians to understand. They don't see what the fuss is all about because their board has really not embraced this maintenance too much. They tell me, well, every 3 years I have to fill out a form. It takes about 15 minutes, no big deal. And you write them a check. Well, that's not what the other boards require. And so if you're a physician listening to this and you want to try to have this alternative board embraced and recognized by your hospital, be aware that when you present it at the medical executive committee meetings and the credentials committees, you'll have maybe out of the 10 people on the committee, you might have one or two that are against this, and they're generally surgeons whose own boards are very, very easy and lenient and have not embraced this. So make sure you educate them as to what's going on in the other boards so that they don't really understand it. And that's an important point. What's happening now is we've moved now to the phase where we have to get acceptance of this new board by the hospitals. So that's the main thing, because the hospital requires board certification for credentialing, and they require board certification by one of these boards that we're against. And so we have to get the hospitals to allow this new board, the national board, to be an acceptable alternative. And that requires, it's harder than you think. Several committees have to approve it, and then it has to ultimately go to the credentials committee and usually the board of trustees of the hospital, because they have to
change the bylaws.
To change the bylaws of how the hospital operates. And that's a project. It's been a project. There are other projects. There are some states have laws that need to be changed. California has a law that says you cannot advertise that you're board certified as a physician unless you're board certified by one of these boards that we're against.
Right.
So we're trying to change that. I was in Sacramento talking to legislature this last week. And that's just, some payers, some insurers won't let you work on their patients unless they're board certified. And we've got to educate those insurers to accept other boards.
How successful have you been at the Scripps Clinic with this?
Oh, it's been fascinating at Scripps. I think this takes, I've not been successful yet, although I'm close, I'm getting close. It takes, Scripps has five hospitals, and they've decided that that they don't want to just change it at one hospital. So I have to go to five hospitals and make sure.
Are they five separate medical staffs?
Yeah. exactly. Mm-hmm. And but one board of trustees.
Okay.
And so and a physician leadership cabinet, which is a chiefs of staff of all five hospitals meet regularly, and that's actually a pretty good system. But it makes it more challenging because I've got to get this. I've got to get five to agree. Our lawyers are concerned very much. I'll give you an example about the legal requirement to not advertise that you're board certified unless you're certified by one of the boards we're against. And their point is, well, on our website, we describe doctors as being board certified. And how do we do what, you know, that would be illegal if they're only board certified by the national board, because that is not legal in California. So I've got to change that law, but I've also got to convince my hospital lawyers that having them listed as approved by the national board is just as good as certified, that the word certified, because you just can't use the word certified. And that's a law that was well intended in California. I mean, at the time it was written, there were doctors claiming to be board certified, and the boards that they were certified by were really not
fly-by-night boards that were being created.
They weren't really,
right.
They weren't certifying anything about you. So I understand where that got started, but we just have to tweak it a little bit to include other reputable boards.
So how are physicians responding to all this, Paul?
So physicians, they fall into three general camps. 98% or so are just completely supportive of it. I have never received so many thank yous in my life about anything. I have people, I mean, I get emails daily telling me that I'm their hero. I mean, there's this pent up anger and frustration that we just sort of seem to do whatever we're told, and we don't really have the time to fight it, and we can't get anything done anyway if we fight it because the establishment's just too big and too entrenched. And that's what I was told when I started this. I was told, I remember the quotes, the horse is out of the barn, you'll never change this. Don't waste your time. So to see the fact that we are changing it, we have a successful alternative, and the boards that we're against have now all started making changes to try and make their boards more meaningful, which is a terrific outcome. We'll see how far they go, whether they go far enough. It's unlikely they'll go far enough, but I welcome them to try. I would love to see that change. So doctors are really, really thrilled. We've already gotten many significant changes made in the boards that we are unhappy with. So we feel like we've made a lot of progress, and we'll continue to make progress, and that's great. Then we have there's two other camps, and they're very small camps. And one is, as I mentioned, there's some surgeons that I've run into that don't see what all the fuss is about. And these surgeons, usually it's because they have not been personally influenced by this. They've never had to really recertify in the manner that we're talking about. So they need to be just educated. I've also heard them say, look, if we don't take a test, the public will never accept it. And I understand that kind of where that's coming from. I mean, tests are usually the metric that we use to evaluate knowledge, but the fact is it's not really that. A closed book test at this stage in your career really isn't relevant anymore, because it's usually, as I mentioned, you're not being tested. You're never going to get a question wrong that relates to your practice. It's only going to be things that you don't relate to your practice. And also because closed book tests don't really matter that much anymore because we have open books. We see our patients with our iPhones and we're online all the time. So you don't need to memorize things that you don't use very often anymore because you've got access to them. So that's one group that needs some education. It's a very small group. And the other really small group is that occasionally, particularly if you're working in the academics, you're going to bump up against a doctor who is working within the structure of the current system. We have an email exchange for interventional cardiology. There's 120 thought leaders on this email list, and we exchange questions and answers about difficult patient problems. So if you have a patient with an issue that you're not sure about, if you want to get 120 people will listen to your question, and about 20 of them will probably respond with their experience with this kind of a clinical issue. You send the question in. When I queried that group about this maintenance of certification, there was 70 indignant replies about how horrible it was, how stupid it was, what a waste of time it was. And then after about a week, we got one guy who's a friend of mine who wrote a long, you know, page and a half about how much data there was to support this and how he was surprised that we had such a negative attitude. And that's when I started looking into the data that he was quoting, and I found out there wasn't any data at all, and it was really very skimpy and spun data. It wasn't really good evidence. And then, of course, I find out later that he's a friend of mine, and, you know, that he's the guy that writes the questions.
Well, we're going to break here. Okay, we're at a hard break. We're going to pick up that very thought at the last segment. So just hold on to that thought, and we'll be back in the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your health care freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
And you're back for the final segment in the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is your host, Dr. Hal Scherz, with my special guest, Dr. Paul Tierstein from the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons in the Scripps Clinic. And in the spirit of full disclosure, we've been talking about the NBPAS, of which Dr. Tierstein is the president, but I am a board member. So I thought that needed to be put out there. So, Paul, just to finish your thought, we were talking about your friend who was an opponent of what you're doing.
Yeah, because, you know, he described all the studies that have been done to prove that maintaining certification is important for patient care. And the problem is when you look at those studies, they don't prove that at all. In fact, they prove just the opposite. And this guy, who is a friend of mine, and has been working with the American Board of Internal Medicine, is a really good guy, and he actually now agrees with me after lots of discussion. And he used to write questions for the board. Now he's actually on the opposing board, and we'll see if he can. I think people like him might be able to get the board that we're against to make some very, very significant changes, which would be really laudable.
So there are really two approaches. It's one working inside the structure, and then the other is working outside the structure.
You know, and they're complementary. And I've learned, you know, as a physician, I've not been politically active in my life much. I mean, I really occasionally donate to a candidate. I once went door-to-door when I was, you know, 20-something years old for a candidate. But I have really not. It's not my thing. But I've really learned about advocacy here, about what it takes. And I think it does take a village. You want to change within the system. You also want alternatives. I think you want that provides docs with alternatives. It also puts a lot of pressure on the established system to change.
But this is, it takes a village, not just physicians, but it takes others who are going to be sympathetic to what people like you or I are trying to accomplish. So why should people care about this?
That's a really good point. So what I would tell you if you're a layperson is when you go to see your doctor's office, just ask them if they know anything about maintenance certification, about their certification. You'll be surprised. The doctor will sit down and talk to you, but it upsets them so much. Because it takes time away from their ability to take care of their patients. And then some doctors are actually retiring because of it. Because they look at it now and they say, all right, I'm 62 years old, enough. I don't need the income. And this is just aggravation. This is not why I went into medicine. I want to take care of patients. I want to help people. This is not helping people.
And 62 is a golden age for many physicians who still have another 10 or 15 years of superb skills to share with their patients and care for them.
Yeah, particularly the docs that have a lot of experience like that are older. I mean, it's really, really a shame that some of them are retiring because of this, and we're trying to put a stop to that.
So, you know, I come at this with a little bit more cynical view of why this is happening, and not to be conspiratorial, but there was several excellent articles that you have shared with people who are on your email list by Kurt Eichenwald from Newsweek online, and in it he pointed out that the American Board of Internal Medicine specifically may actually be engaging in activity that's illegal in terms of their lobbying activity, which they shouldn't be allowed to do, but yet they are doing, and in doing so, they are putting themselves in a position where they are forcing physicians to participate in their efforts in order to get paid.
I think that there have been those allegations. I think that they're certainly out there, and I assume they're being investigated. And if there's problems, they're going to have to correct them, and I'm sure that they will. I personally am not a forensic accountant. I really don't know how to look at these books and determine whether there's been some improprieties or not. So I'm leaving it to others to look at that. And that has not been my major mission.
The major mission is to just give doctors an alternative so that they can refocus their energy toward their patients and keep some dollars in their pocket to keep them from having to divert attention away from their patients and from their personal lives.
Exactly. And we offer an alternative, but we're also putting pressure on the current established system to change.
So what advice would you give to doctors who are listening to this? You've already told people what they should do. Ask their doctors about this so that they can understand the scope and the magnitude of the problem.
So if you're a physician, you know what I'm going to ask you to do is first think about how you feel about this. If you think that the current system is a good system, that the new maintenance certification is something that's helpful to you, then by all means do it. We don't want to stop you from that. That's not our intent. If you agree with us and you think it's wasting your time, then you need to do something about it. And it's what you can do. It's not that hard, but it's going to take you a little time. And if you do it right, it might take you a couple of hours. First, sign up for NBPAS, nbpas.org. It doesn't cost you much. If you're a fellow in training, there's deep, deep discounts also. So sign up, and then that's only the first step. That's going to take you 10 minutes. But we need help. And what we need help with currently, very specific thing, getting your hospital to agree that NBPAS is a valid alternative to the current board. That's the single most important thing you can do right now. We can get to the insurance companies a little bit later, and we will get to some of the few states that have laws that we need to change. It's not many, but the hospital is the key right now, and that's happening all over the country. I mean, literally hundreds of medical staffs are now looking at this and voting on it. And it requires an advocate. I mean, I can't go to every hospital, and I'm not even known at every hospital. That's not the appropriate way to do it. The way to do it is for you as a physician to go to your hospital, and you start with your chief of staff. And if you get nowhere, you get a group of you together, sign a little petition saying, we want this discussed. And on the website, nbpas.org, I have placed all kinds of resources for you to help you with this. A sample letter that you can download and edit to your make to personalize. This letter can go to your hospital administrators. A sample letter that you can send to your colleagues. And you can simply call up your medical staff office and say, I want to send a letter, an email out to all my colleagues at this hospital. And will you do that for me? And most of them will. You probably have a right to, even as a member of the staff. And then a PowerPoint. On the website, there are two PowerPoints you can download. One is designed to be a 12 to 15-minute discussion of this whole topic that you can go to your credentials committee and make a presentation. Very easy to do. It just will take you, you know, it'll take you the time to look at the PowerPoint and the energy to go and do it at the credentials meeting. There's also on the website, if you really want to get more background, a 30-minute video of me debating the ABIM and ABMS presidents on this subject, which goes into great detail on the data, what's wrong with the problem with the current process, and why we think the alternative makes a lot of sense. And not only can you watch the video, but you can download the slide set I used during that and put it into your presentation if you feel like if you have more time to talk to your credentials committee. But that, you know, I realize that that's sort of a pain to do, but it's an important thing, and I think you need to make time for that. And you're not going to have to. If you don't make time for that, you're going to end up spending 20 hours a year doing what we call MOC, maintenance of certification. As opposed to spending a couple of hours, one person in the hospital or a few of you spending a couple of hours advocating for this change.
But, you know, it goes a lot deeper than that. And I know that there are a lot of people listening to this who are physicians and people who are listening who are either related to a physician or have a good friend who's a physician. But there are efforts to restrict physician activity, tie maintenance of licensure, or maintenance of certification, rather, to their licensure in some states. And there needs to be a little bit we need to step back and we need to offer alternatives because I think that you've explained, Paul, why the premise that these boards are able to operate on may be faulty to begin with. But I'll give everybody one last thing that they can do that's very easy to do, and that is to take this podcast, which will be available on on our website on America's Web Radio in the Doctor's Lounge, and send it to everyone that you know who is a physician, and just listen to this conversation, which really just scratches the surface about the scope of this problem. We're coming up to the end. We've got 1 minute, Paul. You want to wrap up things?
Well, yeah, I think this is an important issue, and I think it also gives the doctors a bit of hope that they can make change, and a lot of doctors have been enthusiastic about that and I think inspired. And I certainly have been inspired by it. I think you can make a difference, and that's important to know. And I'll leave you again with the website, since this is radio. I'm going to give you one other acronym: NOMOC, NOMOC.org, .com, NOMOC.org. If you can't remember NBPAS, that website, put in NOMOC.org, and that'll take you to the petition site, and that has a link to the NBPAS website. So if you're trying to memorize the website, just remember, that's easy to remember, NOMOC.org.
Well, You know, Paul, I appreciate you being on the show today. This was a very great discussion on an important topic that is of primary importance to every physician in this country, but also is important to patients as well for reasons that they may not fully understand but are. So thank you so much for being here today as my guest.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I mean, this is a really, social media is very, very important to spreading the word here. It's really been helpful, and this is a terrific example. What a great show.
Okay, well, thank you for being here, and thank you for joining us in the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.